Hello and welcome to Negotiating Ideas, a podcast about political thought on democracy, pluralism, and peace. This is your host, Omar Sadr. The link between transitional justice and socioeconomic harm is an understudied field. The recent debates in the discipline of critical criminology and transitional justice has shed light on how it's important to understand socioeconomic harm, for instance, land grabbing, not just as a simple crime, but also as a state economic crime, and most importantly, as violation of human rights, which should be addressed by mechanisms of transitional justice. This is the subject matter of a recent book published very recently titled Transitional Justice and Socioeconomic Harm, Land Grabbing in Afghanistan by Dr. Huma Saeed. In this episode, I have spoken with Huma. Huma Saeed is an affiliated senior researcher at Leuven Institute of Criminology, Belgium, and an independent consultant on transitional justice and human rights. Huma, welcome to Negotiating Ideas. Pleasure having you. Let me start asking you by the question, give us some overview of key theoretical and policy contributions of your recent book on transitional justice and socioeconomic harm in Afghanistan. And most importantly, how you got interested at the intersection between transitional justice, human rights, and land grabbing.
Thank you very much, Dr. Sadr, first of all, for this opportunity and for your question. Once I actually started the fieldwork, I didn't actually start the fieldwork necessarily focusing just on land grabbing, but once I started the fieldwork, I realized that it is such a huge topic in Afghanistan, even if hardly, you know, people would be willing to give interviews, especially those who were affected by land grabbing because of, you know, impunity around the issue and the fear that they had. It would come in every interview. Everybody was talking about land grabbing, whether it was with victims, either victims of land grab or, you know, generically war victims, for example, in the IDP settlements, or experts. Everybody was talking about it, but we had very little because of, you know, this culture of impunity, because powerful people were involved in this. So that sort of, you know, drew me even further to this issue, and I wanted to understand this from a transitional justice point of view, but I realized that that alone was not a lens to sufficiently enable me to understand and analyze this phenomenon. Therefore, I combined it with an understanding of criminology. And also with criminology, I sort of started like broader. Criminology for me was a new field. I didn't have a background in it. As I had studied political science, then human rights for my master's. But then I had to find a niche also in the field of, which is quite an eclectic field, criminology. I had to find a niche there. And doing studies in criminology, I realized that it's more the broader critical criminology that fits in addressing this issue, because I found within critical criminology discussions discussions on state crime, on crimes of the powerful, on economic crime. And that's how I decided to basically theoretically combine these two disciplines in order to use that lens to study this housing, land, and property harm in general, and specifically land grabbing. And then the book is about that. It's an empirical and theoretical study. Theoretically, it has tried at the same time to also connect the two fields, transitional justice and criminology, which remain still a sort of disconnected field, even if one would think that there is obvious, the connection between them is obvious, but it is actually not. And while doing this study, I realized that there is so much, you know, overlap. There is so much that one field can enrich from the other. But unfortunately, transitional justice scholars and criminologists sort of, you know, remain like, you know, mostly disconnected because transitional justice emerges mostly from, you know, the legal field. It is heavily still dominated by legal scholars, and therefore also it is heavily focused on addressing civil and political rights. Whereas criminology, I mean, there is also some criminological tradition rooted a little bit in legal discourses, But also criminologists, including critical criminologists, they have not really studied much situations of, you know, conflict or post-conflict. That's, I think, one of the contribution, theoretically speaking. And then empirically, I think, analyzing this phenomenon of land grabbing from the point of, from a criminological and transitional justice perspective. And essentially, the two arguments that are presented in the book, one is, very broadly speaking, one argument is that certain degree and frequency of socioeconomic harm can amount to not only crime, but also human rights violations and gross human rights violations. And the other argument could be summarized as, you know, land grabbing in Afghanistan is not only a form of crime. What I refer to here is economic state crime. And that's basically the concept that I have coined in this study, economic state crime, because for the reasons that I explained, that land grabbing is not only an economic crime, it's also not only a state crime, but it's actually economic state crime, a phenomena that is in a kind of symbiotic relationship because of, you know, those kleptocratic system in Afghanistan. The people in power, people who are in official government positions in different degrees or structures, who are involved in land grabbing in order to gain personal profit. And so I analyze this, why this is considered economic crime and why this is considered also state crime. But at the same time, it also amounts to human rights violations and gross human rights violations, right, given its gravity and frequency.
I will come to this economic state crime, but let's go back to your theoretical contribution. And as you rightly highlighted, a unique contribution that the book has is how transitional justice should come along with critical criminology in order to better understand how can we address the issues related to massive land grabbing, housing issues, which are connected with massive human rights violations. So traditional criminology is a discipline which is oriented toward disciplining human beings, as you mentioned in your book. How does critical criminology transfers from disciplining human being, and how do you suggest that it should reconsider the focus should not be about individuals and how crime happens, but also at the broader level, at the state level, it should also evaluate the massive violations of human rights. That I wanted to, if you can elaborate much. And then how about transitional justice? To what extent theoretically transitional justice moved from its conventional, traditional ambit towards a new endeavor, or how did you try to connect it with the new circumstances that you studied?
Sure. So as you rightly pointed out, critical criminology can be considered maybe, you know, a field or a subdiscipline within the discipline of criminology, and it emerged in the 1960s. The 1960s to 80s, mostly in the US, UK, out of some other progressive movements, including, for example, the war in Vietnam, the feminist movement, and it's still growing. I mean, it's still pretty much it's still in the making, but I think it has today has a solid position within the field of criminology. It emerged from the mainstream criminology or conventional criminology because it challenged a number of the main assumptions that conventional criminology had. For example, in conventional criminology, as you pointed out, very often a criminal or crimes were sort of individualized, you know. Sometimes even, you know, the blame, like in the old criminology in the 1800s, I mean, the blame was put on, like, even physically people would be looked at. And there were arguments that physically there are features that we could say that, you know, these people potentially could develop maybe to criminals. Whereas critical criminology challenge this by basically focusing on the structure of society. In the impact of structural, for example, structural issues, structural problems, structural inequalities on crime, on criminalization. And likewise, this also affected responses to, you know, crimes and criminalization. For example, they are much more focused on social justice. They do look on alternative discourses as well as practices when it comes to justice. Their main concern is really about changing the society. They have politicized, in a way, you know, the field of criminology, because that political struggle, that political change for them is very important. Whereas before, our conventional criminology tends to look at criminology more from a kind of, like a functionalist theory, if you look at it from a sociological perspective, you know, seeing society in a kind of equilibrium. Mm. So critical criminologists challenge these assumptions. And then these discourses emerge to, you know, then there are many, many critical criminologists that have very seriously been engaged in human rights, you know, human rights, the discussions on human rights violations. For example, one of them is Stanley Cohen. This is a big name, especially in criminology in general, but it comes definitely from the critical criminological perspective. There are many criminologists that have been involved in discussions of human rights, human rights violations, very critical of governments, of state policies. And out of these kind of discussions, eventually, discussions around state crimes, crimes of the powerful emerge. And as I discuss in the book, there are also various approaches to state crime that I think is still something, it's growing, you know, it's still, there's perhaps not, as in many issues in social sciences, there's not like one, you know, concrete definition, but various approaches that therefore in the book, for example, I had to also find a niche there, like, you know, which aspect of a state crime, for example, could respond to the empirical inquiry or component of the book. And then the crime of the powerful, actually crime of the powerful was first coined by Edward Sutherland in 1946, if I'm not mistaken, and he called that white collar crime. And that, you know, was a reference to crime of the powerful, basically crimes of mostly, for example, corruption. I mean, these days, corruptions being considered as a form of crime or as a form of human rights violations, luckily it has become a relatively common discussion. You know, there are even at the kind of international organizations level, there are now many references to that. And there are mechanisms, but it had started, you know, around that time in the kind of like more white collar crime. Sure. So and then to transitional justice, transitional, like criminology, there have been, you know, these kind of developments also within transitional justice. Over the years, the scholars of transitional justice realized and actually challenged very significantly the heavy legal dominance, in the field, and they brought these other discourses, especially, you know, looking at a kind of transitional justice that looks at the bottom up approaches, that look at, you know, mechanisms that could emerge from communities. To the point that today there is the most one of the, I think, most significant discourses is now called transformative justice. And transformative justice has been developed precisely from such criticisms towards transitional justice. Those who believe that it's a top-down discipline, that it's a one-size-fits-all discipline, that, you know, basically it has become a kind of like a toolkit that, you know, post-conflict society, there are these toolkits, 1, 2, 3, 4 mechanisms, whether it's truth commission or reparations or institutional reforms or trials, you know, even in the case of, for example, former Yugoslavia with the ICTY, There are scholars that are very critical of that. You know, scholars from those countries, from the former Yugoslavia countries, that some are very critical of this trial being seen as top-down. And they're still, the civil society is still are trying in those countries to come up with a kind of like regional truth commission, because they think that that's a better way maybe for the society's reconciliation. So out of these discussions today has emerged transformative justice, which focuses on more bottom-up. It places a lot of emphasis on addressing socioeconomic, socioeconomic inequality and socioeconomic rights violation. They don't necessarily use the language of harm. I have to say, the use of language of harm is one of the very useful terminologies that come from criminology, in criminologists. And I think that that's quite important, because when we put it like violations, you know, that's more of a legal term. And precisely critical criminologists challenge these kind of legal terms, because they say, you know, legal terms, they are defined by those in power. Whereas harm, which I have used in my research for that reason, is a concept that we all as human beings experience. So for that reason also, I sort of adopted more when it comes to transitional justice, you know, the concept of transformative justice, because I became quite convinced, especially after my fieldwork, that Afghanistan needs maybe more transformative justice at this stage than perhaps the typical transitional justice. And I think...
So on this point, apologies. So on this point, to what extent, I mean, why the... Afghanistan is understudied when it comes to transitional justice, despite the fact that Afghanistan had the longest history of conflict and a state, massive state crime, even before the civil wars. But when it comes to knowledge production with respect to transitional justice, little has been done. How can we explain that?
It's an excellent question. It's a question that sometimes I also wonder. I think this is, in part, it has to do with maybe geopolitical interest, because transitional justice is, at the end of the day, it's a political, you know, discourse and practice, and it does require political will in order for it to be implemented. Unfortunately, in Afghanistan, in various phases of conflict, this has been completely ignored. The country itself has never really experienced, you know, in a tangible way, any transitional justice mechanism. The only experience we had was in 2005, you know, with when the action plan was developed. But even that, when it came to its implementation, because of lack of political will by both national and international actors, hardly any of that was implemented. So I think in the case of Afghanistan, it has to do a lot with the lack of political will, with the geopolitical interest. And in fact, my upcoming article is looking exactly at this question, because in my upcoming article, I do address transitional justice through a hegemonic power discourse. And there, this is actually an issue I had looked at in my thesis, in my master's thesis, where I argue that basically because of these hegemonic political discourse, transitional justice was blocked, and its implementation was blocked. Yeah. And I show that through, you know, basically empirical. In that case, there is no fieldwork, but there is enough empirical evidence when it comes, for example, to truth finding, you know, how none of the reports, there is this, you know, one area that I think we have quite good amount of work done is documentation, but none of those reports are available. As a researcher of transitional justice, you know, for more than a decade now in Afghanistan, I haven't seen...
It's hard to access them. It's very hard to access those reports.
It's impossible because, you know, they were never published. They were never made publicly available. For example, the conflict mapping by the Afghanistan former, you know, Human Rights Commission. They've done an excellent mapping exercise, but it's not publicly available. Even when I've asked as a researcher, it was not made available to me. So I think it's that. But I have to say that perhaps no other country is as complex when it comes to addressing transitional justice as is Afghanistan, because we have so many layers of conflict that then also this makes the whole discourse of victim perpetrator, you know, very problematic. You know, a group that was victim under one regime becomes perpetrator under the other, or vice versa. So it's very, very complex.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know if one day there would be some mechanism from where the country may start. But I think it's, yes, unfortunately, lack of political will that has hindered, and there isn't much interest. But I have to say that I have been pleasantly surprised, especially to see some of our own Afghan researchers with this interest. I've been contacted, for example, sometimes by researchers who have found my work, and they've needed, you know, a guidance, or, and this is heartening. So.
Yeah, yeah. Let's go back to the connection between transitional justice on one hand and the issue of HLP, house, landing, and property issues. How do you think it is important to restore justice with respect to HLPs through transitional justice? Or in the other word, how transitional justice mechanisms can contribute towards addressing harms with respect to HLPs?
It is significant because housing, land, and property rights in any society, it's a significant part of socioeconomic rights. As we know, in situations of conflict, one of the areas that is highly impacted, or people's life is highly impacted, is access to housing, land, and property. In fact, research has shown, including my own research with war victims, that after the bodily harm, you know, the loss of a relative or torture, I mean, that kind of harm, the loss of land, property, in housing is the second. And it's significant. Right. I mean, first of all, if you just look, for example, now in Afghanistan, we have nearly 6 million, you know, IDPs, definitely over 5.5 million IDPs in the country. We have millions of returnees. This has been a significant issue in Afghanistan, as it has been in every country that has emerged from a conflict. So for transitional justice that has so far ignored this discussion to an extent, but it is getting more involved now, this is significant. It has, however, been part of peace processes, peace settlements. Luckily, it has been addressed. And there are also some international you know, mechanisms, international, let's say, at least at the level of kind of beyond the statements, really, declarations, perhaps we can say, for example, there is the Pinheiro principles on housing, land, and in property that deals, you know, addresses more this crisis for refugees and displaced people. Or there is the 2005 basic principle and guidelines on the right and reparation for victims of violation of human rights and international human rights law, where they have acknowledged restitution of, I mean, reparations is a part, and as part of reparation, restitution of land and property is one. So it is luckily getting more and more prominence. Including now for transitional justice, one of the issues of transitional justice, the one from last year, was dedicated on addressing housing, land, and property rights, is specifically dedicated on this topic. But as I said, in peace settlements, for example, one of the most successful cases of addressing housing, land, and property rights in the peace settlement was in 1995 Dayton Agreement, in the case of Bosnia and Herzegovina, where they had only as an annex, they had 6 pages on addressing this issue. And then they established a mechanism that was called Commission on Real Property Claims, which actually had quite some power. I mean, it was a recognized body with a kind of legal power to make decisions. Mm-hmm. And they were able to resolve, for example, half of the cases of those who returned. And managed to get back their properties. The same, for example, another excellent example is the landmark peace deal in Colombia in 2016. It's mm-hmm. a very comprehensive, I mean, their peace agreement is really very comprehensive document of over 300 pages. And one aspect of it, I think it has like six main components, but one of them is deals with land issues. And restitution is one. Even before that, in 2011, they had passed a law on victims and land restitution. So some countries now, also in the context of transitional justice, is playing placing emphasis on this because it is it's quite a structural form of, you know, justice in a way, and it can have significant repercussions in terms of community, you know, reconciliation, in terms of sort of more sustainable peace, because another research has shown that when this issue is not addressed, conflict around house and landed property, it can become a reason for the you know, the renewal of conflict. So I think that we already know, research has shown that it's a significant matter that needs to be addressed in these kind of societies if we want to reach a true and stable peaceful society.
Right. So, but at the same time, in order to consider land grabbing as a violation of human rights, not just as a harm, there are, in your book, you discuss some criteria to consider how to consider land grabbing as a violation of human rights. So, and that means that every sort of land grabbing may not be calculated as a violation of human rights. There are certain parameters and limits. How is that? Can you explain?
Absolutely. I mean, land grabbing, as we have also recently seen in Afghanistan, you know, it's a crime. In Afghanistan, it was not addressed as a crime. But in 2017, when, you know, the new law on land management was developed, as well as the new penal code in 2017, they both criminalized, you know, or how the way we say it in Afghanistan, Jurmangori. Before that, it was sort of considered theft. It's still, you know, given the gravity of the phenomenon of land grabbing in Afghanistan, I think that the law really approached it with a lot of caution. Perhaps because of the involvement of, you know, very powerful people. Even the case of Shirpur, you know, when Shirpur happened and there was a commission of inquiry, the matter was at the beginning.
Just for sake of those of the audience who doesn't know where Shirpur is, it's downtown Kabul, a lucrative locality where at the early 2000s, a number of government politicians grabbed land.
Exactly. Thank you. In that case, that land grab was initially considered crime, but slowly, as I was told in an interview with a senior advisor at the government, Ministry of Justice, slowly it was kind of turned into a civil case. So it's to criminalize it in the context of Afghanistan is a new phenomena, and even land grabbing, I think, in general seems to be an under-addressed issue. Maybe I lost track of actually addressing your question. Can you please?
And the question was about how transitional justice can address land grabbing, for example, in terms of impunity.
Exactly.
And so on and so
exactly.
Forth.
Yes. So indeed, the point was this, that land grabbing in any case is an act of crime. But of course, as I discuss in the book, not every act of crime necessarily amounts to human rights violation. But certain act of crimes, you know, can amount. And we have to look at basically two criteria. One is the gravity. That is the degree of the act, and the other is the quantity, and that's level of frequency. So what I've done in the book is presenting an analysis of both gravity And in the case of Afghanistan, this is really grave. Also, in the way this happens, and there I think criminology can help us because you know in the specific criteria that it looks at, including the consequences, the harmful consequences, but also the way that you know it gets done, where it has even led to cases of death, and people becoming deprived of. I mean, some people who have, for example, in the case of Shirpur, they were literally people in their homes when some even having breakfast when the bulldozer came and literally started to destroy their homes. But there also in other cases where, for example, parts, as we know in Kabul or other parts of Afghanistan, they were allocated, they were public land, allocated for maybe a hospital, for a school or for entertainment, but they were grabbed and built, you know, a shahrak, a township or something else. So it has led to severe violation of human rights of people. And also, if you look at the quantity, I mean, the level of frequency, it is we're not talking about just a few hectares. It is at least, you know, it's close to maybe 100,000 hectares of land. According to the data that I have collected, it's something like 4.7 million jirib, at least. That the one that has been registered, but this probably is higher than that. And something like 17,000 individuals have been involved. So it's quite a massive, you know, phenomenon in the case of Afghanistan. And if you look at the details of the stories, I was not able to interview many people who were victims of land grab because of the fear they had. But I think there are very you know severe cases of violation of human rights. That's one part of it. The other part is that many of the people who were involved in the act of land grabbing, they were serious violators of human rights from previous period, especially from the civil war. You know, many warlords. So on top of not being held accountable for the crimes they had committed in the past, especially during the civil war, but even before that, they were given the kind of an opportunity, explicitly or implicitly, to engage this time in this kind of you know crime and human rights violation. So the relevance to transitional justice is significant. I mean, if there is a process of transitional justice, these people have to be held accountable, not only for the crimes they have committed, you know, in terms of violating civil and political rights, but also the socioeconomic or economic state crime of land grabbing as well.
Sure. So based on those two criteria that you outlined, I suppose land grabbing and as a violation of human rights and as state economic crime goes long back to the early foundational moments of the modern territorial state called Afghanistan. It is massive in terms of its quantity, but also gravity of its quality. So I basically refer here to what in Farsi in Afghanistan is called Naqalin, that the settlers from the south to the north and displacement of the people from central part, north and west, to other parts of the book of Afghanistan. For example, Amir Abdurrahman Khan in his own autobiography, he acknowledges the fact that, for example, how he displaced Tajiks of Laghman and Kunar to the south. And similarly, this has been documented, in academic literature to a large extent. Genocide of Hazaras, for example, at that moment also, which is connected with land grabbing. So in Afghanistan, you see intersectionality between genocide on one hand, state crime on the other hand, and land grabbing. But I didn't see in your book, when you discuss, of course, your case study is post-2001, but when you discuss history of land grabbing, you do not refer at all to this land grabbing, which starts with... after the four wars that Amir Abdurrahman Khan waged and continues till 1960s and 70s. This is also connected with controversy that we have in Afghanistan about when to start transitional justice of the country, if anything, to be addressed. Do we need to start with the recent 90s civil war, or should it go back to the communist regime? Should it go back to the autocratic rule of those Khan? Or now, as I said, do we have to address also land grabbing, resettlements, and knocking off early rulers of Afghanistan?
Yes, thank you for that question. I agree with you, indeed, that land grabbing, even if we may not, at that, you know, at the time, obviously, it was not called as such. But I think if you look at it and do the research, it will probably fall within the parameters of what we call land grabbing, also back then. The reason I didn't address it is because I really wanted to keep the focus of my study starting with, you know, the latest phase of conflict, actually since 1978. So basically for none of the, for no other discussions, I looked anything prior to that. And also because I wanted to interview war victims. So these war victims are mostly basically war victims from 1978 onwards. I did not intend to take a kind of historical study. So even at the discussion of land grabbing, I look at it more from, you know, this in the last decades, basically. I should have had addressed it a little bit more, perhaps even in terms of what happened during the Soviet backed, you know, during PDPA regime, People's Democratic Party of Afghanistan, because they also had some, you know, involvement with that, issues of land. But I didn't even address that. And as you rightly pointed out, my focus specifically on the question of land grabbing was, what started during the Civil War, basically, and then went on, and especially as of 2000, 2001, that it there was a boom of this practice, basically. So yes, my focus is more on that period. But when it comes to transitional justice, I mean, like I said before, in the case of Afghanistan, I don't know if we will ever be able to even address the last four decades, let alone, you know, the historical injustices. However, research in other contexts, as well as in Afghanistan, research and practice has proven that unless we address structural and historical harm and inequalities, we cannot really get a peaceful and stable society, you know, let alone a democratic one. So, in fact, I had done a research that was for another project on specifically reparations. And in the interviews that I did with some experts, and almost all the interviews, is special issue of land came up as a form of a structural or historical harm that needs to be addressed. And in fact, even today, I think what is happening, yesterday, you know, there were reports about conflict around land in Saripol or in some other parts. I mean, if you look at these practices, many of them go back to some, you know, at least decades. So we know that this is indeed one of the major discussions, one of the major issues in the context of Afghanistan. I believe that if you want to ever have a peaceful society, peaceful and stable society, land issue needs to be addressed in a significant way, like what is Colombia doing, basically. You know, we need that kind of land reform if we want to achieve a real stable society. So.
Sure. On addressing this issue, and book, you discuss how we can utilize customary practices while designing any kind of future restitution law to address the issue of violation of HLP rights. Why do you think in Afghanistan, instead of having modern agreed law to mechanisms, democratic mechanisms, we should go back to customary practices, and how that will be helpful to address this crime?
Well, it's not really a matter of my opinion, you know. On that issue, honestly, I had no opinion either way before the research. It is what has emerged from the research, from interviewing war victims, experts as well, Yes, there are maybe a few, especially from civil society, who became were quite critical of the Shura and Jirga traditional dispute mechanisms, but many others were making references to them, especially war victims themselves. And I think it is a practice. We know it has many problems, especially when it comes to human rights and especially women's rights and youth. I'm aware of those problems. But it has been a practice that has been going on in Afghanistan for centuries. It's very well rooted. First of all, I think it's very difficult to take away a very well rooted practice. That it is what is happening right now in many communities in Afghanistan. In part, this is happening precisely because the formal justice mechanism has never been there. Exactly. It's people need an alternative, and they found this as an alternative. That's why I think in the last years of the Republic, under pressure from the international community, a law was developed. Although it never had a chance to actually be gazetted and published, but I've seen that law to modernize in a way this traditional dispute mechanism, where they have provisions on human rights, women's rights, and all that. That's one element of it. The other element of it, in my view, traditional dispute mechanisms in and of themselves, just because they're traditional, just because they are not modern, in my view, that's not a reason to throw them away, such well-rooted practices. I think we can reform them. I think we can try to address those problems, but not to throw them away. And interestingly, very interestingly, in the West, including, for example, in Italy, in Belgium, in the US, in many countries, the practice of restorative justice is gaining popularity day by day. And restorative justice actually emerges from traditional dispute mechanisms, like in Aboriginal societies, in Australia, in Canada. And if you look at those practices, they are very similar in some aspects to our Shura and Jirga, dispute mechanisms. True. Actually, one of the criminologists of Afghan origin, Dr. Ali Wardak, has looked at this, and he has written some interesting articles, reflections on this. So I think there are also ways that these judicial mechanisms can become maybe more aligned with restorative justice practices, because I think that the restorative justice scholars and communities in the West, they are increasingly, it's another field that is expanding. Clearly, there are some advantages to it. I mean, this is a response to the dominant retributive mechanism, justice mechanism, where the focus is more on community. And in a society like Afghanistan, where we have so much focus on community, I think this can be, there are ways that this can be, the problems can be addressed.
Okay. But did you come across in your fieldwork any model of customary institutions addressing issues related to transitional justice at the community level, where we could highlight or take it as a model of for future kind of practice?
I didn't come across any, because I don't think there is anything, or at least since my research was only in Kabul, where I didn't actually observe or witness any of these discussions and practices. But this came during interviews, especially with war victims. In many situations, when, for example, if I ask them questions about, for example, restitution or reparation, and I would specifically ask them, how do you think this can be done? And they would refer to Shura and Jirga. And they would say, if we have a credible Shura and Jirga, they will, for example, have the capacity to identify, who is the beneficiary there? Who is with this in that story? Who is maybe entitled? But also, I have to say, I did actually come across one. There was Women's Shura in Kabul, with whom I had, a group discussion with them. And I think this was one of those shoras that was by one of the donors, or maybe it was CARE International, one of the donors that had, you know, as we know, in the last years in Afghanistan, there was quite an emphasis also on like women's shura or women's inclusion in shura. And this group of women really fascinated me. I mean, this was not a specific relation to transitional justice, but as a group, as women in this shura, they were, for example, able to, start with this shura group, but a small group, but they were able, for example, to go to the municipality, Kabul municipality, convince, the authorities at the municipality to construct a school for them in that neighborhood. They were able to convince them to pave their road. So I did actually see it. I heard those people. And for me, if that is a model of shura, I see it a very progressive and modern, version of shura. And I don't see a reason why something like that cannot be encouraged. And I think we can be definitely creative to look at how to use these models for transitional justice-related practices.
Right. So as a last question, if I may ask, definitely transitional justice, as you discuss in your book, is not just a matter of post-conflict societies, but also societies whether conflictual or amidst of the conflict. Now, Afghanistan is also it's one of the very painful, traumatic phases where Taliban are committing massive atrocities, which are unprecedented in its history. But definitely time may come that we should address this. The Taliban and also the last 20 years that you discussed the book and probably, of course, the greater, if you look at the broader historical modern Afghanistan. So what are the key propositions, probably in terms of policy here, I may ask, that you will suggest for any upcoming, now time is of course not clear, probably 5 years, 4 years, 10 years, unclear, but upcoming another phase of state building, post-conflict resettlement and transitional justice in Afghanistan?
It's a complex question, especially in a very complex situation like Afghanistan. But the one thing that the people of Afghanistan want, and that has never happened, the least that they want, not the one thing, but the least that they want is acknowledgement of their suffering. That has never happened. Mm-hmm. No regime in all these political, during all these political transitions, including, in 2001, where there were some hope for transitional justice, no regime has officially apologized, acknowledged the suffering of the people of Afghanistan. And war victims, it's very important for them. When I was interviewing war victims, I was just a researcher, but because I am from Afghanistan, because I spoke their language, because I was there to listen to their stories, they were thanking me. And in many situations, they told me, "You're the first one who has come ever to ask us, what happened." They feel like invisible, ignored. That's why the work of civil society organizations who have, engaged with war victims is so significant. They have empowered victims because for the first time, they give some recognition to this huge category of, people in Afghanistan. It's a huge constituency, according to the 2005, call for justice that was done based on research with 6,000, Afghans. Nearly 70% identified themselves or a close relative as direct or indirect victim, war victim. So it's huge in Afghanistan. Mm. We're talking about a huge population. The acknowledgement of this suffering, that's the first step. But we need so much, We need truth. The victims want to know the truth, even if it's something that has happened 30 years ago, 40 years ago. They still want to know what happened to my father, what happened to my uncle. Does he or she, is there a grave for them? These are important. There is in the international, legal system, there is the right to truth. It's significant. Then, of course, there is reparations. There is trial. I think that, you know, again, if we, our only source of reference still is the call for justice from 2005, because unfortunately we didn't have another one after that. But survey with people there showed that there was a high demand among Afghan people for justice, including trial, but also in other form. They, that survey also undermined issues of socioeconomic harm, but I'm sure that if that inquiry was included, it would have been also very high, addressing, you know, socioeconomic harm. As it came up in my research, you know, people were saying, yes, I want to know the truth. Yes, I want the perpetrator to basically see his or her fate, you know, to see justice. But the first thing is that if I'm hungry or my child is hungry, you know, that is, of course, the priority. So, you know, some of these steps that seem maybe even sometimes development-oriented, but they can be significant in context of transitional justice. And for Afghanistan, if there is a tomorrow with such a maybe hopeful future, I think we need all of this. We would need a very comprehensive transitional justice, you know, approach like the one they have in Colombia. I think that it's a very good model where they pay attention to both civil and political and socioeconomic rights, and it would be a process. Especially in Afghanistan, it would be a very long process, and it also needs to include addressing the structural harm, especially around land issues. I think Afghanistan right. will not be really peaceful if land issue is not resolved.
Not resolved. Yeah, with that, I think we've come to the end of this episode, but I would like to thank you for writing that book, but also speaking with the Negotiating Ideas. Thank you,
sure.
Dr.
Thank
Homose.
You very much for having me.
I hope you also enjoyed listening to Dr. Homose talking about her book, Transitional Justice and Socioeconomic Harm, Land Grabbing in Afghanistan, as much as I did. And last but not the least, I'm truly grateful to all of you for listening to this podcast. If you like our episodes, please make sure to subscribe to the podcast and also share it with your friends on social media. Looking forward to speaking to you on the next episode and the next month. Have a great day.